Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody. This is Kevin Boileau and Nazarita Goldhammer at Epis Radio. Today we're going to continue our discussion about critical design. We're going to jump right into it with Nazarita and talk about some of the discourses that go into critical design, what's at stake here, why would we even want to have a discourse about critical design? What sorts of some other discourses can be helpful to understand what's going on in the world? So some people want to re-envision architecture, interior design, community design. Unfortunately, we can't just throw out all of the old science and all the old discourses. That would throw us into absolute nihilism and chaos. We need to work with what we have and then create new paradigms as we go. So let me give you an example of why I think that's so. You can't take a city and dismantle it and just, you know, take a bulldozer and bulldoze it to the ground and then create something new. You have to take parts of the city, piecemeal them together into something new. Singapore is working on this. Copenhagen, Leuven, Belgium, they're all working on having zero carbon footprints. And so they're all engaged in redesign of their community, which involves interior design, exterior design. And I think that's really part of the challenge is how we take what we have right now and develop it into something new. For me, the big challenge is going to be that most people don't want to focus on self-structure. It's too hard. It's too emotionally difficult. They don't want to think about psychoanalysis. They don't want to think about critical theory. And so the problem with that is that their focus is just on the noetic, the objective world, the noematic focus, the intended or intentional world that we objectivize. And we all do that. You know, that's endemic to being a human being. But what I think we need to do is to also focus on the noetic structure of the noosphere, not only for culture, but for individuals, so that we can engage in a giant collaboration and systematically take steps towards redesigning the way we interface with ourselves, with the earth, with the biosphere, with other life forms. So you can imagine that going all the way down deep into a profound ontological meta discourse is going to be really difficult. There will be people who will want to do it, but it means giving up everything. So I don't think that's workable. I know it is for a few people, but I don't think it is as a whole. So somehow we have to have a current system, a transition system, and a new system. So I'd like to introduce Nazarita to the show. The topic of today is to bring into the equation some of these other discourses and really talk about how we can use these other discourses to help us create a manageable praxis. Number two, to think about what this means for individuals. Are we capable of that kind of change? So without further ado, Nazarita, welcome to the show. We'd really like to hear your comments.
I only have a few comments on this to begin, and that is, When we think about any area that we want to redesign, including ourselves, I think what gets in the way of most people is that what they want to do is that they're satisfied with small changes, tiny change, because it's not as bad as it was, and it's not as good as they can't even envision as good as it could be. They want to make minute changes. But someone with vision, and when we go to redesign something, you have to have an intention of what redesign really is. How do you want to redesign something? And that means that you have to open yourself up without limit to what can be. Not well, the structure is this, and therefore we can only imagine this little bit to go forward. Otherwise, you know, we can't throw everything out because then it won't work. It's like if you can't open to actually looking at redesign in a way that says, let's just look ahead in a way that actually envisions something totally new. Now, there are many kinds of redesign, of course, and many different ways to do it. Some are very small, like let's take the current structure and just make it a little better. Let's tweak it, and therefore it works a little better. But let's keep everything that we have. Let's just tweak it a little. But real vision means that you have to see where it can go. For the time, the few visionaries that there are really in the world, they're looked at as people who, what would I say? They're radical. They're radical, and most people want to throw away their ideas. Like, oh, that could never happen. You know, get rid of them. And that's what our pedestrian society says. They look on anything that is extremely innovative as something that will not work for the masses. And that's because a lot of people have very limited minds. They don't want to go to that place of redesign. But the purpose of vision in redesign is to imagine a way to do things and the way to build, and the way to structure, the way to interact in a way that defies the structure that is. And it says, what could possibly be better? That's where some of the newest things come from that actually in years past have come actually to be. Like nobody could ever imagine an electric car. People said, no, you have to have gas. You have to have gas. I mean, that's the end of it. We can make gas better, but a true visionary would say, let's eliminate gas altogether. And there's a group of people, as you know, would say, have said, you can't do that. You can't do that. That's not the way it's done. We can make this better. And so that's what I think we always fight about in ourselves and with other people, is the limitations that we think we need and that make us feel more secure, that prohibit us from really expanding a vision. And that's what I think that we're striving for in design with other species, interaction with our houses, and interaction with everything that we talk about. Like, how can we have a vision to change that gets rid of things that prohibit us from being free in that vision?
Could you give a simple example for our listeners where somebody might have a radically new vision, a great vision, and how that would bear out in the details and in a concrete praxis? If we could just take a look at an example, then we can talk together and help our readers understand, or our listeners, how difficult it can be to implement great plans. I'll give you one simple example, and this is not architectural design. This is healthcare design. So back in the day, it was the early 1990s, and Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton had created a new way of doing healthcare, and it was going to be a movement towards a single payer system. And it was an amazing idea. They thought it out. It was a structure. It was really different. It was truly visionary. And it got shot out of the sky. And the reason for it, all the pundits would say, and they should be listened to, is that it was too difficult to go from the current system to this awesome system that they have in many European countries now, that there was no praxis and there was no transition. And it was really sad, right? And we're still dealing with a healthcare system that's broken. Can you think of like a design issue, a simple one, that our design firm would want to replace, and how we could get people to buy in to that new vision? That would be helpful for our listeners.
Well, what immediately comes to mind, especially in what you were discussing, two concepts that are not in design, but they're ones that I thought of immediately, is that when people try to redesign a healthcare system, they're not really looking at health. They're looking at a disease care system. They're saying, how can we manage a disease care? And that becomes a quote-unquote healthcare. So it's not really visionary. What it says is, how can we make better the way that people pay, the way that they go to a doctor, but it's not really health care. It is disease care. And so I think that's why we've been limited in the way that we address, supposedly the correct word is healthcare. Instead, we're focused on disease care. And here's a great correlation that relates exactly to that, is that, you know, doctors used to take care of patients and do autopsies and on, you know, cadavers, and they never washed their hands because they didn't believe that germs that could be carried on the skin or the air. And that was science. Science says, well, you don't have to, there's no such thing as that. That's ludicrous that there are germs that would stay on my hands, because that was ludicrous. And every doctor in that day thought that was ludicrous. But it doesn't mean that it's true, because a group of people thinks, and they're predominantly in charge of things, that's true. And so, of course, they revolutionized, you know, the way that they handled disease, because they found out that germs were carried through unwashed hands, which is, if we look back, we think that that's kind of incredible. We think that people who thought that had to be totally, you know, on a lower level of thinking. But they just didn't know. And I often think this about design, that design is innovative. Innovation irritates people. It makes them want to attack. It makes them want to put down. They want to keep the established way of doing things because it's safer. It's supposedly been proven. But it's real innovation. For instance, I look outside and I see all these houses that are huge and close by. And I'm always thinking, how do we redesign communities? How do we redesign houses? How do we redesign the way that we interact with nature in the midst of a population explosion, to where we are exploding with humans that destroy so much of that desire for interaction? Like, how do we really do it? And here's something that we've talked about, is that people are now realizing, very few, trees actually are communicative. And this puts a lot of scientists in a tizzy, because it says to them, oh my God, these are people who think in fantasy, because they don't want to embrace that thinking or to explore it or to entertain those thoughts, because that goes against established patterns. And anytime you start to think innovatively, then you're going to go against established patterns, and you're going to have lots of enemies, and people are going to talk shit about you because they don't want that to be shaken in any way. And so we have to look at ourselves, like, what prohibits us from opening our minds and our hearts? Like, why wouldn't we want to be open our hearts to others, to other species, to plants, to animals, and to the earth. Why wouldn't we want to do that? And so that's the basis for me of redesigning how we live. I just saw a sofa that, well, actually it was a chaise. And it was totally redesigned. It was made out of a malleable fabric, not even fabric. It was a new concept that supported the back, but can be used in many different ways, flexibility. Didn't even look like a piece of furniture. It looked like a piece of modern art, and yet provided comfort. And my immediate reaction, which is typical, was like, wow, is that really possible that we could have that and entertain that concept, be comfortable and have that in our house? And I like to embrace new things, and I really considered that, like, okay, how can we make that even better? Like, how can we redesign it so that, you know, it addresses so many things? One, the environment. Is it sustainable? Does it really help humans? And what about if you're living with another species? You know, can they use it? And so these are all thoughts that I have that I think are always looking at ways to create something new. And so I'd like to hear what you have to say on using some of the ways of thinking, like phenomenology, how we would use that to be more innovative and to open ourselves up to a more creative way of looking, designing, being in the world, interacting with others. How do you see that? Because I know that these are fields that you're really adept at. So I'd like to hear that.
Right. So let's just use some basic critical theory. Which comes from Marx, middle of the 19th century, 1800s, Marx and Engels, and which has now developed into a very prominent literature. It's very complex, not easy to understand, but it's a structural approach. And in a structural approach, the idea of most humans having any kind of a self-constituting consciousness or agency is just simply false, which I actually agree with after 40 years of study. Not everybody gets the chance to see things for what they are. We would like that to be the case, but it's just not. So if you take structure, language, the economy, socioeconomic position. You layer on top of that the unconscious, personal unconscious. It's really easy for me to accept that there's a lot going on that people cannot know as a group. Some people can know. In fragmentary ways, sometimes called perspectivalism. You know, you can only know your perspective, and I can only know my perspective. We can try to share perspectives, and sometimes that happens, and that's really good. But in a culture, when you've got millions and millions of people, it can be really difficult to get a democratic polity on the same page. And that's one of the current critiques in political science right now, is whether or not democracy actually works. Now, the vision of democracy is great. It's wonderful. The notion of direct democracy, which is a version of democracy, is awesome. Everybody's vote counts the same. You get one vote. You make decisions. That's a really beautiful idea. But when you have a country that has so many people and so much complexity, we know from the research that direct democracy is impossible. So we have what's called representative democracy. You know, we elect people hopefully they will represent our position or as closely thereto as possible. And then they go and they have these great big fights and debates at the state government level and the federal government level in Washington. So the devil is in the details. You have a massively complex decision-making system, number one. Number two, you have people all over the country with some shared needs, but mostly many groups of shared needs, but not shared needs as a whole, other than to talk about it abstractly. Most people want peace. Most people want a good meal. Most people want a good night's sleep. Those are easy ones. But when you start breaking that down into the details of where a person's going to live, how they're going to conduct their life, what they want out of their life, what they have to contribute, it becomes a very complex discourse. And you can have two people who have such radically different experiences of life that it can be very difficult for them to even talk together. And the best they can do is to say, with great honesty, I don't understand your way. I will never understand your way, but I'll respect it. And you'll never understand my way, but I hope you'll respect it. And leave it at that. And that's not what goes on in much of America right now. People are really hell-bent on power struggles and winning something, whatever it is they want to win. And so they fight. It's a great violence in American policy setting and decision-making and implementation. So phenomenology is a discourse that's very useful for some people that opts out of those power struggles and has a methodology in which we see the real. If you engage in the method and you're practiced at it, you have an opportunity to step back and gain some perspective and see things as they really are. Of course, that's arguable, right? You have the structuralists and the psychoanalysts saying, you know, you can't do that no matter who you are. That's too difficult. You can never escape the effects of power and distortion in a culture. That's one really important debate. Number two, psychoanalysis operates on two levels. One, the cultural level, and two, an individual level. And if one does accept the method of psychoanalysis, then we would always be suspicious about what we think is true. Because if we're mature people, we say that what we think is true might not be true. And that is the power and the force and the absolute brilliance of psychoanalysis individually and culturally. It's a way of seeking the truth for oneself and one's own life and as well as culturally. So you have critical theory attempting to debunk cultural distortions by engaging in discourses about the economy, power. You have psychoanalysis talking about this in a different way, that people live in a sense of ignorance. There's a lot of repression, both individually and culturally. I believe it's absolutely true that people push to the side what they don't want to know. And in fact, I've seen this happen in the so-called sages, the so-called gurus. It's really easy to out-debate them. They usually don't want to debate in that way because they have a hubris that they see all, and they don't. They're ignorant as well. So we all live in that state where we're trying really hard to overcome the distortions of culture. Now you layer on top of that capitalism, the frenetic nature of capitalism. What that does is it exacerbates distortion because capitalism ends up becoming the dominant signifying system, which it is in this country for sure. So you have that. So that means all other value systems are subjugated and suppressed. Then you have the lies that people in power tell the working class to keep them working. And you would have to, because if you don't, why would people work for $8 or $9 an hour, $12 an hour for decades and gaining absolutely nothing and working themselves to the bone, becoming unhealthy? Because working all the time will make you unhealthy unless you engage in countervailing behavior. So, now to read an answer to your question, these discourses purport to offer us methodologies that are super, super complex. I've never met an average psychoanalyst. They're all extremely astute. You'd have to be. You'd really have to be. You'd also have to be very brave to do that kind of work. But then when you layer that on top of the structural problems that Marx and Engels point out, and then all of the second, third, fourth generations of critical theorists, you start seeing even more advanced and complex discourses. To be sure, phenomenology is a standalone discourse, and it holds that if you employ the methods correctly, you can see things for what they really are. In other words, a purely descriptive understanding of a phenomena in which you do not become entangled in those complex discourses of critical theory and psychoanalysis. It's a way of overcoming hermeneutic distortion. And so I do agree with you. I know from our discussions that phenomenology is being used in a lot of other discourses and implementations. It's used in psychotherapy, just like it's being used in cultural analysis. And I firmly, you and I have used it in design conceptions. I want to always be intellectually cautious, but I do believe that the more developed practitioners of phenomenology can use its methods to, as a kind of I would call it like a dialectical anchor, in which we're able to purify ourselves from distortion as much as possible. Now, these are not perfect, right? These are not perfect methodologies. Any methodology that purports to tell you that it is the royal road to, to clear and unadulterated knowledge, that's false. Those are illusions. So that's kind of an introductory way of thinking about it. But let's take a step back and let's look at things that, like, really practically. Let's just be pragmatists. So I know from my own experience that most people do not want to entertain psychoanalysis or critical theory. It's too hard. They want to stay in the Cartesian-influenced, basic flat-footed position of consciousness. And at the risk of sounding arrogant, I think that 80 to 90% of the population is in that stage, where they believe what they can discern in basic consciousness. Now, without employing any kind of specialized methodology, that is the consciousness, I believe, that is given to us through the phenomena that critical theory studies and the phenomena that psychoanalysis studies. If you can do a psychoanalytic investigation of Trump and why he's been so effective, you can do a psychoanalytic investigation of Adolf Hitler. He was fantastically effective at propagating ideology and making people think certain things. It's a great example. And there are people who are just as sure as the day is long about certain things when those things turned out to be absolutely false. So we need to have more. This is one thing we agree on, is we have to have critical. We have to have critical discourses about apprehending reality. That's epistemology. Epistemology, the logos of knowledge. What do we know? What are our foundations? I would never just trust my flat-footed experience. That's immature. I would always want to weave my experience through more critical discourses and reflection. Now we're in trouble. Why are we in trouble? Because most people don't have time to do that. That's the problem. So not thinking pessimistically, and I'm not at all a pessimist, but I'm thinking the devil is in the details. How do we get people out of certain destructive belief systems that are harmful to culture and to individuals? How do we get people motivated? And that is the right word, motivated to even consider being a collaborative designer to where we're all reimagining the world, to make changes. When most people right now, and especially right now, Nazarita, they're wondering where the next meal is going to come from. They don't have jobs. They're standing in welfare lines. And even without that, a lot of the working class work 50, 60, 70 hours a week, 80 hours a week, two jobs, and they can barely do their job, let alone think about a different way. I don't have the answer for that. And I know that's where we're working in our design firm. How can we help people consider? How can we affect that noospheric space, the noetic space of individuals, so they can tap into their creativity, so they can participate in this wonderful potential for redesign? How do we do that? That's my question back to you.
Well, I think that there are certain degrees of innovation and opportunities in people to redesign. And that's not saying that everyone who thinks about it can actually redesign. Maybe they implement better. Maybe they hear about something and they're the person that can talk to others about it. So, you know, there's a quote, and I just read it. It's Robert Peters, a designer. And he said, which is what we've talked about many times, he said, design creates culture. Culture shapes values, and values determine the future. So in this, I was thinking about the cell phone. The cell phone, when it was first invented, there was some big phone company, and they said, oh, this will never catch on. People don't want to carry around phones all the time. And you look at that now, that innovation, which wasn't that long ago, and you have to think to yourself, wow, everybody has a cell phone. As a matter of fact, in the last few years, those people who didn't embrace a certain technology, they're left out of a discourse of necessity, like getting their necessities. If they don't have a laptop computer, they don't have a computer at home, it's very difficult for them to get necessities of life. As far as opening up redesign, especially now when people are looking, where is their next paycheck coming? How are they going to eat? We have to look at how do we get our food? A lot of farms are connected to big agribusiness, to where they have their produce, either one, trucked somewhere else to another city, or they're growing food for, you know, to grow pigs and cows, and not food that people can just eat right now. And so this is an opportunity for innovation and redesign. A lot of people are starting to think that way.
I would like to interject something, not to interrupt you, but to interject something. Okay, I'm all for it. Everything you just said, I'm in. I'm 100% there. A lot of people talk about the benefits of farm to table, organic vegetables sold in farmers markets. I think people love it. It brings people together in community, which is another benefit, to get people participating together in community. It creates more conversation, more interaction. Great thing to do. But what came to mind is something that we've talked about. We were in Southern California, in a major city, and there are some grocery stores that sell very cheap products, right? Non-organic vegetables, foods that we wouldn't consider healthy, high sugar, and those are competing with the organic grocery. And to my knowledge, it's a lot more expensive. Like, if I go to a store that has both organic and non-organic vegetables, the price differential can be really big, right? So you've got a person who is barely making ends meet, and they've only got so much money. They've got that $20 bill. They've got to feed a few kids. They're in the store, and they're looking at, you know, the really good fancy organic vegetable or the non-organic vegetable. That's a tough spot to be in, right? And then, and to push that example a little bit more, you've got fast foods, drive-ins. And somebody is trying to make a living. They're on their way to work. They can either go to a store and get some really healthy vegetables that they can try to eat during work, or they can get a fast food burger, two of them even, for a few bucks. It's really tempting, I think. And so the concern I'm trying to drive at, not necessarily an argument, but a concern, is how does a person who's barely making it, who has extremely limited economic financial options, get that healthy food? That's what I'm worried about. How does that happen? How can we make that happen? How can we get the healthy choice to everybody?
Well, I'll give you some of the Band-Aid solutions that have been implemented. Some of the and I call it Band-Aid solutions because they're not addressing the real problem. It's like healthcare. Healthcare isn't healthcare. It's disease care. Let's be real. And so when people don't have enough to eat, it isn't because food isn't available, though people try and say, well, we just need to open up more grocery stores. And here's some of the Band-Aids. There are some cities that have implemented, like, food trucks that go around to sell vegetables at a lower price so that people who don't have a lot of money can actually buy fresh food as opposed to bags of Cheetos. Or you know, the burger at McDonald's for a dollar. And so, but it isn't the real problem. The real problem, when you start to redesign, you have to get to the very root of what is causing the symptom. It's like, so you and I have talked about this, there's a book called Lawn People. Everywhere you look, there are lawns. And lawns are sprayed in order to look green perpetually with pesticides and herbicides and growth hormones so that they look perfect. And yet, to cut out pesticides doesn't actually solve the whole problem. The problem is, why do we embrace lawns? Why are we the cultural concept of lawns? And when we want to get to the heart of why people can't have healthy food, why it's not available, it isn't because there isn't a grocery store around the corner that sells it. It's that we have created an economic caste system that prohibits people from being able to fully live their lives and have the most healthy, prohibited that. So the problem isn't really about food. It's about the caste system that pushes people into a position where it's not available. it isn't the availability, open it up and it will become miraculously available and they'll be healthy, because that really isn't it. If they don't have the money to buy the vegetables, you can have all the vegetable trucks you want, but they can't afford to buy them. So, you know, we have to look at, we have to dig and find the cause of problems. You know, to have better health care, which, you know, we know is a misnomer, that you can't have more doctors. More doctors isn't going to solve the health care problem. Making hospitals
so
more
you're
accessible
talking about,
is not.
What you're talking about is a critique of the socioeconomic system. That's what you're talking about. And what's quite an irony is it's quite an irony that it actually costs a lot more money to produce meat than it does vegetables. It's a total irony. And then we end up selling the meat burgers at McDonald's and Burger King for cheap, actually pretty cheap, but costs a lot of money to make them. Well, wouldn't it be interesting? I'm kind of going along with the way you talk about design implementation. Wouldn't it be really interesting if we could set up community plant-based, let's just say delis, community stores that actually will help you prepare your food. So you're on your way to work, you're flying down the road in your car, you've got 10 minutes to get to work. You can either get the two burgers on the right side of the road, or you can go to the left side of the road and get a really nice plant-based vegan meal for the same amount of money or less. Pop in and pop out just as fast and you go to work. So we've talked about this. Like a design change would be to have fast food vegan, but to have a lot of it. You know what I mean? Not just in Southern California, but to have a lot of it so that people have the choice. But they don't seem to have the choice right now, do they?
Well, they may not have a choice, but there's a deeper problem is that we allow marketing to misconstrue the value of things. So we have all this marketing that is promoted by the meat and dairy industry that everybody, at 90% of all people would say meat is the best source of protein. You have to drink milk for strong bones. Like here's an experiment that they did about fluoride. Fluoride in the water and fluoride in toothpaste. They said, do you know what fluoride is? And every single one of them, I mean, 10 out of 10 people said, well, fluoride makes your teeth strong. Everybody across the board, youngest to oldest, all said the same thing. But it isn't true. That isn't something that's true. And yet everybody believed it. So you can offer, the beginning was offering fluoride-free toothpaste, along with education on why fluoride is actually harmful to you and why we shouldn't have it in our water or our toothpaste. And yet, when you offer it side by side, if someone doesn't know, chances are they're going to choose what they've been marketed to, which is the concepts that they have ingrained in them that are at the root cause of people making bad choices, actually. They make a bad choice because they believe it's better. And why do they believe it's better?
Right, this was marketing. You're absolutely right that the marketing downplayed and suppressed all the knowledge about the dangers of putting fluoride in the earth, fluoride in the water. Absolutely. Now, we're totally out of time. And here we are. We're having a great discussion. Let's take our notes and let's just come back to this very discussion next week. When we start again, thank you for being on the show, Nazarita. As always, really like talking with you, always, 100%. And let's pick it up next week. Thank you for everybody for being here with us. Don't hesitate to go to Amazon.com and buy our Radio Conversations series. They're informative, they're cheap, and they will help us stay on the air. Thank you.